Okay, everyone, we're going to get started here. This is an experiment for me. What I'm going to attempt to do is recall a keynote speech that I gave about 2 weeks ago. I think it's still relevant. It is April 2024. So this is going to be a recap, as best I can from memory, maybe an abbreviated version of the keynote speech I gave at a recent conference that was focused on consumer and esoteric asset classes within the structured finance world. But my keynote was really broader than that. It was about consumer credit more generally. And so I think it kind of fits the theme of my YouTube channel and the content that I'm putting out. So bear with me as I kind of figure out some of this technology out as I'm using it for the first time. But really what I'm just going to do is roll through my deck and again, try to recap some of the main points that I made for that keynote. Let's start with kind of the theme, the overarching theme. And this is something that you've probably seen in my research that I have on LinkedIn, the newsletter, Consumer Credit Matters. And that is this consumer credit paradox that, as I refer to it, which is really just trying to capture the idea that we have headline macroeconomic statistics, particularly those that are germane to consumer credit performance, that are just going quite well, let's say. Solid at worst and strong, I think, is probably more accurate by most measures. We're going to look at a few of those. I selected a few of those to talk about. The paradox part is that consumer credit performance, again, headline, big picture, isn't doing so well. It's worse than that, in fact. It's doing quite poorly. And so why is that? That's something that I'll explore a little bit in this presentation. So that's kind of what you're in for here with this presentation. So I hope you like it. So let's get started. First slide here is, that's the wrong one. Here we go. There we go. Debt levels. Okay. So maybe you've seen this type of chart before, maybe you haven't, but this is especially for those of you who are just tuning in by just audio only. This is a time series chart that shows a secular rise in consumer debt levels. These are all sources or all major sectors of consumer debt. So mortgage debt being the biggest, 71%. And then you have credit cards, auto, student loans, home equity, and another category kind of stacked on top of it. But again, if you're not able to see this slide, it's an upward sloping rise in the amount of debt outstanding. And what you'll immediately notice is that we are at a record level of consumer debt outstanding at $17.5 trillion. That's a lot of debt outstanding. And what you might also notice is, as you look at the more recent years, is that the level of debt has been accelerating. And we kind of probably, if you think about it, know why that is. At least some of it is caused simply by consumers continuing to spend, and more of that spending is happening now on credit. So there is certainly a willingness to spend and a willingness to spend on credit. And a lot of that is, you can see in the GDP prints of many quarters on end now, that the U.S. economy, which is powered on, right, 70% of the U.S. economy is powered on by consumer spending. A lot of that is done on credit. That is what's going on here. Consumers are spending, and they're spending more on credit. That's part of the story, and that's an important part of the story, especially as we think about consumer confidence. I'm not going to really go into that in a lot of detail in this deck, but you know, there's been a lot in the headlines about consumer confidence being actually on the downside. But if you look at what people are spending, or you know, if they're voting with their pocketbooks, as it were, they're continuing to spend, and that is generating kind of above average GDP growth rates. But it also means that they're building up you know, more debt. And the other reason that I think you may forget about as to why there's been an acceleration in these debt levels is inflation. And yes, inflation has been in the headlines, but it, you look at, you know, a secular rise like this, it's easy to forget because we haven't had to think about it in a few decades because inflation has been so low, that this is really also contributing to this kind of the optics here. And I did one of my articles, I just did a very simple exercise of putting credit card debt over a shorter span of time. It was like from 2019, so pre-pandemic, prior to the run-up in inflation, through the end of 2023. And basically all of the rise in credit card debt, which are now nominally at record levels, was explained by just the inflation rate. I think I used the CPI, the core CPI, as the deflator there. But essentially, if you put things on a real basis, so end of 2019 to the end of 2023, credit card debt hadn't really moved much. So a lot of this increase, this ramp up, or in this acceleration in the debt levels, is caused by the ramp up in inflation. So as inflation comes in, maybe the pace of this should trail off a bit. But again, the take home here, we're at a record level. Not only the top line, $17.5 trillion, but all of the individual categories are pretty much at or very close to all-time records. So that, of course, is creating concerns around, you know, the health of the consumer, the household balance sheets, which we're, of course, going to get into here. So let's move on to the next slide. And this is kind of to bring that big picture down to a more, call it, pedestrian level. In this case, on the right here, I have a chart. Again, for those who can't see the chart, this is a time series data for new and used average financed amounts for auto loans, with the new, of course, being higher than the used. But the take home here is that they're both showing a secular rise from early 2020 to the end of 2023. The good news here is that rise has been stabilizing or plateauing as we've seen inflation come in on new vehicle and used vehicle prices. And actually, used vehicle prices have been dropping now for over a year. So that's a bit of good news, bodes well for kind of the future kind of debt levels, if you will. But I think it's helpful to put consumer debt in kind of, real world terms. So average auto loan prior to the pandemic and now for a new car went from $530 to $740. Huge, huge jump, right? That's $210 increase in the monthly payment if you had a loan on a new car back then versus if you're getting one today. And that, again, new car prices are higher, the loan amounts are higher, and the rates are higher. That's all contributing to that. And the used car, similar, not quite as big, but from $390 to $530. Pretty large increases. Credit cards, another big category of consumer credit. Rates are at or near record highs, and card balances for those who carry a balance are between $7,000 and $8,000. So it's not a trivial amount of debt and debt burden. And then student loans, of course, which were on a payment moratorium during the pandemic, at least the federal student loans, which is the bulk of 90% of student loans outstanding are the federal, either direct or the so-called FFELP student loans. Those have come back online as of the end of last year. Payments are now required to be made. And on average, that's another $267 a month that consumers need to pay. That's a lot of money. You add all this up, and it's a lot more money that consumers need to spend, or households need to spend and get in the habit of writing that bigger check every month. So that's putting some burden on borrowers. So now let's just take stock in what we just saw. Record high debt levels and record high, debt service with respect to some of these big categories of loans. So let's keep the narrative going. And I don't think that's the whole picture. And that's why I like to go to this next slide. And I really like to focus on the debt service ratio. This is also put out by the Fed. This is, for those of you who aren't aware, the debt service ratio is a measure of debt service in the numerator, as the name would suggest. This is how much consumers are spending on various forms of, or households are spending on various forms of consumer debt each month, your monthly payments, mortgages, autos, student loans, and so on, divided by, and this is the important part, divided by personal disposable income. So it is a ratio, and that ratio, if you can see the chart here, is at or very close to a record low, which means that those debt service payments, when you now look at it relative to income, is very low. It means that the households are in a good position and are fairly resilient position to kind of weather some of the economic storm that we've been going through. And that explains, you know, I think some confidence in some of the consumer spending that we talked about earlier. So what's happening here? I'm going to just dig a little bit into the, or decompose this debt service ratio a little bit, because I think it tells an interesting story. One of the things that's happening here is that those who have a mortgage took part in what I call the mortgage refinance boom, or pandemic-induced, call it, mortgage refinance boom, where in the early years of the pandemic, when the rate environment was still rock bottom low, 75% of borrowers who had a mortgage refinanced and got themselves these, you know, a refinance rate that is just of nearly historic lows. I think if I remember correctly, the statistics are for everyone who has a mortgage, 75% of mortgage holders have a rate below 5%. Or no, it was 80% have a rate below 5%. 60% have a rate below 4%, and 25% of those who have a mortgage have a rate below 3%. Any one of those is very, very low by historical terms. And so a large swath of Americans who have mortgages are locked in at these long-term, very low rates. And that provides a lot of resilience. Of course, that also means that there are a lot of Americans, because only 65% of households are, you know, homeowners. So that leaves another 35% who are renters and left to kind of the prevailing inflationary winds that have been blowing very hard when it comes to shelter inflation. And they have been, you know, not as resilient. Now that, you know, put a pin in that thought, because that's going to, we're going to come back to that when we start to look and talk a little bit about the credit performance and why we're seeing, again, helps explain why I think we're seeing some of this paradox that I referred to. So the other thing that you'll notice, so we have rock bottom debt service ratio for the mortgage component of the debt service. The other component here is called other or non-mortgage consumer debt service. That is trending higher. And I expect it will continue to trend higher as we move into this so-called, you know, higher for longer rate environment. It's not likely, according to most economists, that we're going to go back to a long-term period of, you know, very low interest rates like we'd been enjoying for the last, call it 10 plus years. It's more likely that we're going to, you know, revert back to something lower than where we are today, but not quite as low as where we were. So that's what I think most economists are referring to as a higher for longer rate environment. And that affects the other forms of consumer credit more quickly because A, they're shorter term, right? Your average auto loan is between what, 6 and 7 years, or 60 and 72 months, call it. And, you know, credit card debt, of course, is floating rate and resets with the monthly prime rate often, or some type of floating rate index. So those, even though they're much smaller, will eventually start to take on more weight, more of an impact to the headline debt service ratio, putting more stress on households when it comes to their debt service. But that's going to take a long time to kind of affect the top line debt service ratio. I think it, when I say long time, I mean something measured in years, plural, because people are really, they're going to hold on to those mortgages for as long as they can, in all likelihood. That seems to make logical sense. Okay, moving on. can't talk about consumer credit without talking about the jobs market, labor market. But I am going to move through this next slide very quickly because the jobs market is picture perfect. It's really, you have to squint extremely hard to see anything. And I tried, but I couldn't find anything that was weak when it comes to the labor market. The unemployment rate ticked down last print. After ticking up a couple of months, I thought that might be something to talk about, but it really isn't. It's stable and very low by historical terms. Job creation continued to surprise on the upside, and yet we don't see inflation, wage and income inflationary pressure that is causing kind of a worrisome a death spiral in wage and price inflation. That was a legitimate, I guess it still is a legitimate, but it seemed to be a more pressing concern, just a year or so ago. Economists were warning and very concerned about wage inflation kind of taking hold and starting to drive in this vicious cycle of wage and price inflation spiral. But that has not taken root. And in fact, wage inflation now is pretty close. It's closing in on, let's put it that way, to where it is or where it was prior to the pandemic or prior to the high inflation rates taking hold. So that's good news there. That looks like that's coming in as planned, as the Fed is planning. Layoffs remain low. Initial and continuing jobless claims, insurance claims, uninsurance claims remain very low. I have a couple of things. Job cuts remain extremely low, as do the quits rate and job openings. They're not in the stratosphere where they were. I'm talking about the quits rate and the job opening rate. They're not in the stratosphere where they were a year or so ago, but they're back into a territory that I would call normal or normalizing. So again, no weakness here to talk of at all. So we'll move on from the labor market. Obviously, if people have jobs, they're more likely to pay their credit back. So that's the underlying principle there. Next, we'll look at underwriting. I got some, this is the Senior Loan Officer Opinion Survey. So this is soft data going back over the last 7 quarters. Again, if you can't see it, it just shows that according to this survey, loan officers are indicating they've been tightening on a net basis across the various consumer credit categories, autos, credit cards, and basically a proxy for personal and secured loans here, consumer X auto and card. That's good news and bodes well for the loans that are being underwritten over the last year and a half or so, almost 2 years. So we're going to come back to this. I'm going to zoom out a little further than the last 7 quarters. It tells you a little bit of a different story and might be an explainer, another explainer for the paradox. We'll come back to this. Next slide is just showing again another now hard data look at some of the underwriting standards. Now we're looking at FICOs on the top of credit. This is credit scores across time for auto loans. And again, the take-home message here is that FICO scores on average have been stable to improving. Okay, so strengthening or underwriting is tightening by that measure. And the next chart really is making the same point in a different way, just showing that when you look at FICO scores by bucket in the various subprime, call it near prime, prime, and super prime buckets, you see that prior to the pandemic versus today, there's been a move out of the riskier bucket into the least risky bucket. So that's the take home there. I have a bullet point here that puts a question around whether FICO inflation is at play here. That's been something that's been raised to me in my conversations with market professionals. I'm going to come back to that because I think that is going to be an interesting topic that we'll cover in, again, discussing the paradox in credit performance. Okay, so here's the first shot at credit performance, and this illustrates the paradox well. So I've just gone through, macroeconomically, a lot of strengths, a lot of tailwinds that should be helping the consumer and households, right? We said okay, debt levels are high, but debt service ratio is quite low. So people or households are able to handle that debt, with an asterisk around homeowners versus renters, kind of dichotomy. We'll talk about that. Underwriting has been tight in the last year and a half, almost 2 years. And the labor market is very, very strong. So now we look at the performance and we're looking at delinquency rates here for autos, credit cards, and student loans. And we see for autos and credit cards, not only is the delinquency rate higher than it was prior to the pandemic, but it's on a very steep trajectory. And at least in the case of autos, it's actually not that terribly far from where it peaked out during the Great Financial Crisis, which is astounding to me because we are at a very different, we are in a very different macroeconomic environment today, as I said, strong versus 2008, 2009, when the economy was, you know, we were all looking down the abyss at that time. And it's just astounding to me that, you know, credit performance is as poor as it is along those two measures. Now, I have student loans here. They are at rock bottom and have flatlined for the last, call it 3.5, 4 years. And that's because, again, that payment moratorium that was in place. And then on top of that, even though payments are required now as of the end of last year, there is still continues a moratorium on the performance data being shared with the bureau. So it won't be until the end of this year that we start getting a look at some hard data on student loan repayment and delinquencies on a like-to-like basis. But I would fully expect that the delinquency rate for student loans will shoot right back up to where it was prior to the pandemic and might even go past it, given what we're seeing in the other consumer credit categories. Okay, the next slide here is looking at kind of one of three, what I call intersections of risk. So these are kind of scaffolding or call it an analytical framework that I've used to kind of help explain why we're seeing this paradox. What are some of the drivers? And the first of these intersections of risk is younger borrowers. So point here, I've got, again, for those listening, delinquency rates over time, and they're stratified by age cohorts. And what you see is, okay, younger borrowers have always tracked higher in terms of delinquency rates. They are riskier borrowers than older borrowers. Why is that? Well, again, they haven't yet hit their peak earning years. They haven't had time to build up, financial resilience by way of savings and so on. That's not that surprising. But what is surprising here is that you see in recent quarters a growing separation between and among the younger cohorts and the older cohorts. And here I'm going to define younger cohorts, roughly speaking, as millennials and Gen Z, right? So, you know, again, why is that happening? I'm going to go back to what I said earlier, and that is that, you know, these cohorts of younger borrowers have they haven't yet hit called household formation milestones as at the same place in their lives as some of the older cohorts have in the past. So this has kind of been in the headlines that younger borrowers, younger generation of borrowers are hitting household formation, particularly home ownership, right? That's the big one. They're hitting that milestone later in their lives, if at all, than their parents did, for example. And that means if that's happening, and it is happening, they were not able to participate in that pandemic refinance boom that I mentioned. And therefore they are the renters, you know, they are feeling the inflationary pressures that that are affecting shelter, rental shelter in particular, much more so than the homeowners who were able to participate in the refi boom. So that's explaining the younger borrower differentiation here. And as long as inflation, shelter inflation in particular, but inflation in general remains high, I think you're going to see this separation continue. So something to keep an eye out for. moving on, and I have the same slide. That was for what do you call it? Auto loans. And this next one is for credit cards. Same trend, really, that I just referred to is happening in both autos and credit cards. That's the take home. So that brings me to the second intersection of risk. That's for subprime cohorts. And you might be thinking, well, yeah, subprime cohorts perform worse. No kidding. And that's what we see here. Chart again, time series chart showing three cohorts of delinquency rate for autos. I have another one behind this for credit cards. Shows the same pattern, and that is, look, riskier cohort of borrowers by FICO, and here it's defined as 620 and below, have always tracked at a fairly significantly higher delinquency rate. But what we're seeing again when we look at more recent quarters is that worse performance is accelerating. It's separating from the less risky cohorts, the near prime and the prime borrowers. Why is that happening? Well, some of this could be, and this is, you know, not in completely idle speculation, but some of it could be that those borrowers are certainly more cash strapped, and they took on more debt than they should have or can perform. So there's an inability, because they're under financial duress, an inability to keep up with their payments. So it's an ability, not a willingness, kind of narrative to explain some of this. But what one paper that I came across from the Fed, and I might do a separate podcast just on this paper because I found it was interesting. It was a recent report put out by one of the Feds in January that tried to explain this separation in a different way that I think is worth talking about. And that is, basically, they made the observation that there has been a secular decrease in the size of the subprime cohort over the last 10 plus years. And so you have essentially a shrinking population that accelerated during the pandemic. So it got even smaller still as those borrowers migrated to higher FICO strata. So what effect that had was we call this adverse attrition, but it left still riskier borrowers in a smaller pool of subprime cohort. And that exaggerates then the delinquency behavior in that subprime cohort. The ones that moved to a higher cohort, the near prime, or even maybe even the prime cohorts over that period of time, are in now a much bigger pool. And so even if they do perform or they do go delinquent at a higher frequency, because those are bigger denominators, they're not going to move the needle as much. And what they did, just a simple but clever kind of analysis, is they were able to freeze the borrowers in the FICO that they were at in 2019 and follow their behavior through, I think, the end of 2023. And in so doing, were able to explain virtually all of this separation or acceleration in the delinquency rate for the subprime borrowers. So, again, I think that was interesting. What it tells you, basically, the take home of that is that most, if not all, of this increase, relative to the performance prior to the pandemic, can be explained by this rating. This credit score migration. Another thing to think about as we're looking at these numbers. Even with that in mind, though, you can still see that delinquency rates are trending higher than they were prior to the pandemic across all strata. So there's something else going on here again. Moving on, well, here's the same data for credit cards, just to show you the same exact narrative, nothing new there. Okay, the next slide here is on underwriting, another and last of the three intersections of risk. Now, this is, again, I told you I'd zoom out from the senior loan officer opinion survey. So this is now going back to January of 2020 through the first quarter of 2024. This shows a loosening of underwriting standards during the pandemic years, the teeth of the pandemic years, Remember, I said the last seven quarters, so from 2022, say, to 2024, there'd been tightening. That's good news. But there had been a significant loosening going on during the pandemic. If you recall, there was initially there was concern in the March of 2020 as the pandemic was really breaking and unemployment soared. But very quickly, it was, you know, those concerns were allayed when, you know, the federal government and stepped in with a lot of subsidies and servicers and lenders applied all sorts of relief measures that were very effective, I think, in providing assistance and aid and help to borrowers who needed that help. But at the same time, it lifted their financial profile, certainly made underwriting difficult, and maybe there was more loosening than what should have been taking place. That might explain some of the deterioration in performance that we're seeing today, because it takes some time for this loosening to manifest itself at scale. It also, so that's the bad news. That what might be the silver lining here is that eventually that loosening, that you know, span of almost what, a year and a half of loosened underwriting will quote unquote burn out, right? I mean, those borrowers will not be around in, you know, those poor performers won't be around for much longer. And so you might see some of this more conservative underwriting take root and start to bend the delinquency curve for the better. Okay. And this last slide is really a hodgepodge of many of the articles and topics that I've talked about, or I should say written about, in my Consumer Credit Matters newsletter that I publish on LinkedIn. So I'm going to leave it here. You can I'll complete it for those who are only listening. This is like on topics like the Third Circuit ruling that happened about 3-4 weeks ago. This was a Third Circuit appeals court ruling in a case that involved the CFPB versus a student loan, some student loan trusts. And they actually arrived at a decision that surprised most, I think, securitization professionals, credit professionals in the securitization field, in that they basically allow for a path to find the trust and therefore the trust assets liable in certain, you could call them narrow circumstances, but in the case that was being reviewed, if the servicer is found liable, then the path doesn't end with them. They can pursue remedies at the trust level. That's big news because, you know, really securitization since inception has done everything to structure, legally and otherwise, their transactions to isolate or insulate to a very large degree the trust and the trust assets from the liabilities of other third party contracted, other contractual third parties like the servicers. So this is a big deal in that field. There's the CCCA, that's the Credit Card Competition Act, which is a bill wending its way through Congress today that can affect the credit card network providers, particularly Visa and MasterCard, as the largest incumbent credit card networks, forcing competition among them and the two other smaller players, American Express and Discover Card Networks. That would have, if implemented, if passed, far-reaching implications to swipe fees, which really are a whole other topic, I would say, but these are the fees that that power on a whole kind of important economics to the credit card business model, including, by the way, rewards programs, those swipe fees that are charged to the merchant every time you pay for something with plastic, help pay for the many different parties that that allow basically credit to work in this country, actually around the world. And this law would alter that to some degree and And, you know, it's good to know about what the implications for that are. So I would point you to my article covering that topic, if you're interested. And then some other topics, CFPB capping late credit card late fees. That's moving them from an average of $32 to $8. So that's a big, big change for the industry. And, you know, the credit card issuers are going to have to make up for that lost revenue in some way, shape, or form, because they're in the business of maintaining their margins and making a profit. It is, I should say, being challenged. That is not in force yet. If the challenges are unsuccessful, the challenges from, you know, industry participants is not successful. If those challenges are not successful, then you can expect those late fees to come down. I think June 1st of this year, if I'm not mistaken. And then I talk about some other articles there that surging insurance premiums affecting credit and affordability and others. So I'll point you to the Consumer Credit Matters newsletter from there. So that's it. That was really what I wanted to say. This abbreviated version. I hope you got some value added from listening to this and possibly watching this. Do stay tuned. I'll have plenty more to talk about in the future. So thanks for listening, and hope to talk to you again soon.